the Swiss. Chapter 12. Morning and Joy in Germany. Zwingli's indomitable firmness delighted the friends of truth, and particularly the evangelical Christians of Germany, so long deprived, by his captivity in the Wartburg, of the mighty apostle who had first arisen in the bosom of the church. Already many pastors and believers, exiled in consequence of the merciless decree which the papacy had extorted from Charles V at Worms, had found an asylum at Zurich. Ness, the professor of Frankfurt, whom Luther had visited on his road to Worms, wrote to Zwingli, "Oh, the joy that I feel at hearing with what authority you proclaim Jesus Christ! Strengthened by your exhortations those whom the cruelty of wicked bishops has compelled to flee far from our desolate churches." But it was not in Germany alone that the adversaries were plotting against the friends of the Reformation. Not an hour passed in which the means of getting rid of Zwingli were not discussed. One day he received an anonymous letter, which he communicated immediately to his two curates. "Snares surround you on every side," wrote his secret friend. "A deadly poison has been prepared to take away your life. Never eat food but in your own house, and only what has been prepared by your own cook. The walls of Zurich contain men who are plotting your destruction. The oracle that has revealed this to me is more worthy of credit than that of Delphi. I am your friend. You shall know me hereafter." On the next day after that in which Zwingli had received this mysterious epistle, just as Staheli was entering the water church, a chaplain stopped him and said, "Leave Zwingli's house forthwith. A catastrophe is at hand." Certain fanatics, who despaired of seeing the Reformation checked by words, were arming themselves with poniards. Whenever mighty revolutions are taking place in society, assassins ordinarily spring from the foul dregs of the agitated people. God watched over Zwingli. While the murderers were beholding the failure of their plots, the legitimate organs of the papacy were again in commotion. The bishop and his counselors resolved to renew the war. Intelligence of this reached Zwingli from every quarter. The reformer, in full reliance on the word of God, said with noble intrepidity, "I fear them, as a lofty rock fears the roaring waves, son to Theo, with the aid of God," added he. On the 2nd of May, the Bishop of Constance published a mandate, in which, without naming either Zwingli or Zurich, he complained that speculative persons were reviving doctrines already condemned, and that both learned and ignorant were in the habit of discussing in every place the deepest mysteries. John Vanner, preacher of the cathedral at Constance, was the first attacked. "I prefer," said he, "being a Christian with the hatred of many, to abandoning Christ for the friendship of the world." But it was Zurich that the rising heresy required to be crushed. Faber and the bishop knew that Zwingli had many enemies among the canons. They resolved to take advantage of this enmity. Towards the end of May, a letter from the bishop arrived at Zurich. It was addressed to the provost and chapter. "Sons of the church," wrote the prelate, "let those perish who will perish, but let no one seduce you from the church." At the same time, the bishop entreated the canons to prevent those culpable doctrines, which engendered pernicious sects, from being preached or discussed among them, either in private or in public. When this letter was read in the chapter, all eyes were fixed on Zwingli. The latter, understanding the meaning of this look, said to them, "I see that you think this letter refers to me. Please to give it me, and God willing, I will answer it." Zwingli replied in his archoteles, a word which signifies the beginning and the end. "For," said he, "I hope this first answer will also be the last." In this work he spoke of the bishop in a very respectful manner, and ascribed all the attacks of his enemies to a few intriguing men. "What have I done?" said he. "I have endeavored to conduct them to the only true God and to Jesus Christ his Son. To this end, I have not made use of captious arguments, but plain and sincere language, such as the children of Switzerland can understand." And then, passing from a defensive to an offensive attitude, he added with great beauty, "When Julius Caesar felt the mortal wound, he folded his garments around him, that he might fall with dignity. The downfall of your ceremonies is at hand. See at least that they fall decently, and that light be everywhere promptly substituted for darkness." This was the sole result of the bishop's letter to the chapter of Zurich. Since every friendly remonstrance had proved vain, it was necessary to strike a more vigorous blow. Upon this, Faber and Landenburg cast their eyes around them, fixing them at last on the Diet, the supreme council of the Helvetic nation. Deputies from the bishop appeared before this body, stating that their master had issued a mandate forbidding the priest in his diocese to make any innovation in matters of doctrine, that his authority had been despised, and that he now invoked the support of the chiefs of the confederation to aid him in reducing the rebels to obedience, and in defending the true and ancient faith. The enemies of the Reformation had the majority in this first assembly of the nation. Not long before, it had published a decree interdicting all those priests from preaching, whose sermons, in its opinion, were a cause of dissension among the people. This injunction of the Diet, which then for the first time interfered with the Reformation, fell to the ground. But now, being resolved to act with severity, this assembly summoned before them Urban Weiss, pastor of Fislesbach near Baden, whom the general report accused of preaching the new faith and rejecting the old. Weiss was set at liberty for a season at the intercession of several individuals, and under bail of 100 florins offered by his parishioners. But the Diet had taken its position. Of this we have just been witnesses. Everywhere the monks and priests began to recover their courage. At Zurich they had shown themselves more imperious immediately after the first decree of this assembly. Several members of the council were in the habit of visiting the 3 convents night and morning, and even of taking their meals there. The monks tampered with these well-meaning guests, and solicited them to procure an injunction from the government in their favor. "If Zwingli will not hold his tongue," said they, "we will bawl louder than he." The Diet had sided with the oppressors. The Council of Zurich knew not what to do. On the 7th of June they voted an ordinance forbidding anyone to preach against the monks, but this decree had scarcely been passed. "When a sudden noise was heard in the council chamber," says Bullinger's Chronicle, "which made them all look at one another. Tranquility was not restored. The battle that was fought from the pulpit every day grew hotter. The council nominated a deputation before which the pastors of Zurich and the readers and preachers of the convents were summoned to appear in the provost's house. After a lively debate, the burgomaster enjoined both parties to preach nothing that might endanger the public peace." "I cannot comply with this injunction," said Zwingli. "I am resolved to preach the gospel freely and unconditionally, in conformity with the previous ordinance. I am bishop and pastor of Zurich. To me has been confided the cure of souls. It is I who have taken oath, and not the monks. They ought to yield, and not I. If they preach lies, I will contradict them, even in the pulpits of their own convents. If I myself teach a doctrine contrary to the holy gospel, then I desire to be rebuked, not only by the chapter, but by any citizen whatsoever, and moreover to be punished by the council. We demand permission," said the monks, "to preach the doctrines of St. Thomas." The committee of the council determined, after proper deliberation, that Thomas, Aquinas, Scotus, and the other doctors should be laid aside, and that nothing should be preached but the gospel. Thus did the truth once more prevail. But the anger of the papal partisans was augmented. The ultramontane canons could not conceal their rage. They stared insolently at Zwingli in the chapter, and seemed to be thirsting for his blood. These menaces did not check Zwingli. There was still one place in Zurich where, thanks to the Dominicans, the light had not yet penetrated. This was the nunnery of Odenbach. Here the daughters of the first families of Zurich were accustomed to take the veil. It seemed unjust that these poor women, shut up within the walls of their convent, should be the only persons that did not hear the word of God. The great council ordered Zwingli to visit them. The reformer went into that pulpit which had hitherto been confined to the Dominicans, and preached on the clearness and certainty of the word of God. He subsequently published this remarkable discourse, which did not fall on barren ground, and which still further exasperated the monks. A circumstance now occurred that extended this hostility, and communicated it to many other hearts. The Swiss, under the command of Stein and Winkelried, had just suffered a bloody defeat at the Bicocca. They had made a desperate charge upon the enemy, but Pescara's artillery and the lansquenets of that Freundsberg whom Luther had met at the door of the Hall of Assembly at Worms had overthrown both commanders and standards, while whole companies had been mown down and suddenly exterminated. Winkelried and Stein, with members of the noble families of Nielingen, Diesbach, Bonstetten, Scudi, and Pfiffer, had been left of the field of battle. Schwytz especially had been decimated. The bloody relics of this frightful combat had returned to Switzerland, carrying mourning in their train. A cry of woe resounded from the Alps to the Jura, and from the Rhone to the Rhine. But no one felt so keen a pain as Zwingli. He immediately wrote an address to SCHWYTZ dissuading the citizens of this canton from foreign service. "Your ancestors," said he with all the warmth of a patriot's heart, "fought with their enemies in defense of liberty, but they never put Christians to death for mere gain. These foreign wars bring innumerable calamities on our country. The scourge of God chastises our Confederate nations, and Helvetian liberty is on the verge of expiring between the interested caresses and the deadly hatred of foreign princes." Zwingli gave the hand to Nicholas de Flue, and followed up the exhortations of this man of peace. This address, having been presented to the Assembly of the People of SCHWYTZ, produced such an effect that they resolved to abstain provisionally from every foreign alliance for the next 25 years. But ere long the French party procured the repeal of this generous resolution, and SCHWYTZ, from that hour, became the canton most opposed to Zwingli and his work. Even the disgrace that the partisans of these foreign treaties brought upon their native land only served to increase the hatred of these men against the intrepid minister who was endeavoring to avert from his country so many misfortunes and such deep shame. An opposition, growing more violent every day, was formed in the Confederation against Zwingli and Zurich. The usages of the church and practices of the recruiting officers, as they were attacked conjointly, mutually supported each other in withstanding the impetuous blast of that reform which threatened to overthrow them both. At the same time, enemies from without were multiplying. It was not only the Pope, but other foreign princes also, who vowed a pitiless hostility to the Reformation. They did not pretend to withdraw from their ranks those Helvetian halberds to which their ambition and pride had been indebted for so many triumphs, but on the side of the gospel there remained God and the most excellent of the people. This was enough. Besides, from different countries, divine providence was bringing to its aid men who had been persecuted for their faith.